India is a very heterogeneous country, right? Everyone has very different demands, very different needs, languages. Hence, you will, in spite, even if, let's say, Amazon, Flipkart want to serve everyone, just because the needs are very different, you will not be able to make out for those, you know, long tail use cases. And those long tail use cases are good enough to build sizable businesses.
Hello and welcome to the Startup Operator Podcast. I'm Roshan Karyappa. We've seen how e-commerce has accelerated post-COVID, and with that, e-commerce enablement businesses like GoQuick have become really important for merchants. In this conversation, I speak to Chirag Taneja, who's the founder and CEO of GoQuick, about some of the trends that he's seeing in the category, how they're helping merchants improve conversions, and some of the high-level challenges he's solving for the business, like prioritizing the product roadmap or hiring the right people for the job. This is an amazing conversation. A lot of insights in here that you might find useful. So let's get started on this podcast with Chirag Taneja. Hey, Chirag, welcome to the Startup Operator Podcast. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thanks, Roshan, for having me. Very, very excited to do this.
Yeah. So Chirag, you have a ringside view to how e-commerce is evolving, you know, from D2C to social commerce to plenty of things. You know, to begin things, how do you see this changing e-commerce scene, especially in India? You know, I mean, post-COVID, there are plenty of things that have happened. So could you, you know, talk about a couple of things from your perspective, what you're seeing?
Sure. And, you know, I'll now, of course, we have a ringside view, but I'll give you a perspective to it. From the time I've been in e-commerce space, and I'm in this space for almost 5 years now. And I have seen that, in fact, another number to give you, I think 2014, we were at close to, India e-commerce was close to $5 billion. Now it is close to $55, $60 billion, right? So in 7 years, we've become, what, 12, 13x. And if you look at it from that perspective, going from 50, 60 to 350 is like 6, 7x only, right? And in which we have done all the foundational work, as it is said. First million is always tough. So we've done the hard work. And I think, of course, helped by COVID a lot. One of the few things, one of the, I would say, only thing which was positive out of COVID. And I would say that, you know, of course, in 2019, when COVID hit us for the first time, I was running Bombay Shaving Company, and we were seeing our numbers on our website become double every month, quadrupling every quarter. And same was happening for some of our partner competing brands as well. And that happened across, you know, e-commerce, not only outside of, or not only Amazon, Flipkart, horizontals, but across, D2C boomed, et cetera, et cetera. And what we have seen is, whenever waves open up or lockdowns are lifted, then you typically see offline opening up, and there is a small amount of dip which happens. But that dip, in my view, or at least what data indicates, it doesn't last more than 10 days. And I think what's happening is that replenishing inventories in offline stores also takes time. And what I keep hearing now these days is that one, online is of course convenient, sticky behavior, all of that. And when people have gone to stores also, they've realized that the inventory there is a little old, it's dated. Hence, people are again moving back to the online behavior. So one, of course, that's sticky, more convenient, etc., etc. And when people are moving out also, you're seeing that they like this experience better than the other one. The inventory, the assortment is better here. And, you know, I think online has been able to find one element which has been better than offline at all moments. And I see that continuing. And in terms of numbers, we're seeing, you know, in spite of March, April not being peak seasons in our country, we continue to see, you know, e-commerce grow across brands 25 to 30% from a March to April number. So continue to see growth. And the expectation is, at least I have been vocal about it, that I have a very strong data-backed belief on this, that we're going to have 25 Mama's boards in 5 years, and very, very legitimately possible now.
Right. No, it's pretty awesome, actually. You know, in the early days of Flipkart and Myntra and the likes, I mean, people would often talk about this 10 million user ceiling that we would hit, right? I mean, the only those are the only users that, you know, e-commerce will cater to and so on. But we've gone way beyond that right now. And also what's interesting is we're seeing this whole non-Amazon, non-Flipkart wave that is happening right now, right? I mean, outside of these mainstream platforms. I mean, of course, Shopify pioneered that in the US. I mean, here we're seeing a bunch of folks, right? The likes of Meesho, Trell, and the others. What do you make of that?
Our GoQuick as a thesis is backed on that India is going to have a lot of shopping which is going to happen outside of Amazon, Flipkart. And, you know, if I go back to 2019, there was a clear camp that D2C is not for India. Outside of Amazon, Flipkart is not for India. I think in the last 1.5-2 years, that narrative, or at least I know that the camp has shifted completely to now people becoming super gung-ho that this is the space to be in. I think both answers are wrong. One was absolute no. This one is absolute, you know, that there is no other place to be than D2C. I think the answer is somewhere in the middle. But it's a reflection of, at least the euphoria is a reflection of capital markets, so to say, or bull run globally. But otherwise, you know, what I have seen is that India is a very heterogeneous country. Right, everyone has very different demands, very different needs, languages. Hence, you will, in spite, even if let's say Amazon, Flipkart want to serve everyone, just because the needs are very different, you will not be able to make out for those, you know, long tail case use cases. And those long tail use cases are good enough to build sizable businesses. As e-commerce expands, you can imagine that these small problems, if they have tailwinds, then at scale, they become large businesses opportunities. So that's how I look at it, as we were discussing, like in the opening, that from 50 to 350, if it's a 7x growth, you just need to be in the right place and compound month on month, right? That's all you need in businesses. Just sit there tight and ensure that you solve for the merchant and continue to grow month on month.
Right. So on that note, you know, what do you make of ONDC? I mean, it seems revolutionary, right? What are your thoughts?
Agree. I think revolutionary in terms of the overall thesis concept, what they're building out. I would still, at least what I'm hearing, and I haven't gone deeper, very deep into it, but what I'm hearing is that still early stages of being rolled out. Hence, you know, there are at least camps in there where people, at least the grown-ups feel that this is not going to work in India, etc., etc. Whereas a lot of phone pays, logistic companies are participating in the phase one rollout. I think it has its own nuances in terms of what all can they power. Can it truly be a UPI-based open network, you know, digital commerce? Can supply be listed that way? Because supply then has to be rated. It'll come down to whether those are reliable suppliers or not. We've all seen what kind of, you know, impact a cloud tail can do, which is a trusted, reliable one. It has multiple nuances to it. And I wouldn't say that I'm an expert in this. I'm trying to go through this thesis deeply now. But I personally want something like this to work out. We've all seen impact of UPI in our country. And this can have a similar kind of impact which can be scaled globally.
Absolutely. So as with any growing market, right, there are second order solutions and e-commerce enablement itself has become a huge category right now. And there's plug and play infrastructure for an entrepreneur to literally start a business over a weekend, right? I mean, you have, you know, everyone from delivery to Commerce IQ to GoQuick, your startup as well, helping entrepreneurs. What is this category like? You know, what are the contours of this e-commerce enablement category?
So Roshan, think of it like that there is a space which is happening, which is growing at a massive pace. And during COVID, people were pushed to, there was no other option. You had to do e-commerce. And I come from those days when, you know, budgets were allocated in consumer product companies, that if you had a 100 rupee budget, 80 rupees got allocated to offline and whatever was left was given to digital. The COVID changed the narrative completely, wherein now budgets are fixed for digital. And then at least it's got the seat on the table. So from those days, you know, this space is expanding rapidly. And there are people who are starting up their businesses to people who have got some sense of PMF are now scaling up to, you know, people who are well scaled up are now looking at increasing margins. Right. So everyone has a different need in terms of how do they solve for e-commerce. And in e-commerce, I would say largely you would look at tech specific works for which you require a developer. Can there be a e-commerce company which can solve for that in a plug and play manner? Right. That's how I would look at it. And I think a lot of companies can be born if you look at it from that lens. And if there is a developer, can I automate that work in so that a developer is not required? Hence a company can be born there, because we all know that as we move ahead in this technology journey, developers will get scarce, will get expensive, and companies which don't have a technology DNA will find it difficult to attract that talent, even if you have capital. Right? We are seeing that happen in India and so many other companies. So that's how at least I define the space. And then, you know, e-commerce has these four broad buckets: discovery, selection, conversion, retention. So you will have problem areas in all of them.
And there are many companies which are trying to give power to all the e-commerce players in terms of solving different problems in these buckets, right? Wherein you have shipping aggregators solving for fulfillment needs. And there are many such players in US, Shippo, aggregators, as well as gateways. Similarly, you know, you have checkout companies, you have, as you mentioned, Commerce IQ, which give intelligence, which give tracking details. And then if you start to move ahead, then there are funnel related problems that people who help you visualize the funnel in a better way. Over time, you know, there's this emerging space of co-op marketing, which is that brands get together and then advertise on each other's space. So very, very different areas which are emerging. But largely in these buckets, trying to solve for the problem can start from being a CAC problem to a cost problem. So right. all over it, yeah.
Well, it's an interesting way of looking at it, right? I mean, thinking of displacing the opportunity cost of having a developer to solve, you know, one of these problems in the four buckets. You've had an interesting journey. You know, you were a chief revenue officer at Bombay Shaving Company, working very closely with the founder. What were those learnings there that led you to go quick? Because, you know, you had a job that you loved and you were clearly very successful. And of course, we all have multiple ideas. We get ideas every week and every month. But what was that unique insight that pushed you off of your normal life to say that, no, I have to do this now?
So I have been in startups now for almost a decade now. So started in 2013 and it's the life which I like. And you know, what happened was, if we would have met in February 2020, I would have told you that, you know, I'm not going to do any more startup. Bombay Shaving Company is my place and I'm doing very well. Just that I think COVID happened, and what became clear was, which I was explaining you earlier, that India e-commerce will significantly happen outside of Amazon Flipkart as well. Right. So that was one trigger point for me. And two, I was a merchant myself. I used to face certain kind of problem statements. And I thought that, okay, if this space is going to expand, then these problems which are today minor will become major when it comes to solving these problems, right? And typically in businesses, you would want headwinds in your business, tailwinds in your business, and you want them to grow fast. And some meaningful problems. So I have always had a lens of that. Is this a vitamin problem? Is a painkiller problem? So those kind of lenses, that can I survive without it, or will I immediately as a merchant resort to taking the solution? Those are learnings from my past experiences, that you know, what kind of problem. And then of course we've always looked at GTM as one of the important things. I've been taught by my fellow founders that in technology businesses, GTM is super important. It has to be as smooth as you put knife in a butter. That's the level of smoothness GTM has to have. And you know, that's how it started. And of course, I knew the merchant pain points. I came from that side. And another thought was, you know, after doing a CPG business, consumer business, typically the path is that one would say that I should have gone on to do a consumer business, right? I understood a lot of brand, a lot of content, products, how to market them online, etc., etc. But I think what became clear to me was that while I had done that business, I understand that business. I always was fascinated by technology and how technology can solve problems at scale. And if I hear the finance, business finance hat, then this is a very high leverage business, right? You can create massive impact if you get the product right, if you get the team right later on. So I thought, okay, this is my at least opportunity at building out a tech business, which can be very, very fascinating. So that was the at least thought point at the starting.
Right. And what was that process of initial customer validation, talking to people, understanding if this is really a critical problem for them and, you know, how much or what they will pay and so on, right? I mean, what was that process like?
So we still follow that. And I think the way at least we go about it is that we typically, you know, and I've seen people getting confused in this, in GoQuick also, we separate problem discovery from problem solution. So for example, if somebody sends me an invite and saying, we are going to discuss about this problem, then either it has to be a discovery meeting or a solution meeting. You can't have one meeting in which we discuss both. So I think that's the ground rule if you want to solve a real good problem. Because what happens is if you've not discovered the right problem, right, then you will end up giving a wrong solution. So The more emphasis has to be given on, have we discovered the right problem? Yeah. I think all problems are solvable to an extent. Just that, have we articulated it the right way? Have we understood it the right way? If it is articulated, then you will find that there are many brilliant people in the country who can solve it. In fact, in our team also, we've seen that if we articulate it rightly and ask them, have you got it? It becomes a different ballgame. And I think that's how it started. Now, of course, as the team has expanded, so now I have started to write this, that problem discovery separate from problem solution. We started with that way that I knew certain problem pain points for merchants. And I thought that, okay, if this is the problem statement, there was no validation which was required for the pain point. Now it had to be articulated that what exactly is the problem statement? Is it a symptom or is it the core? If you are in the business of solving symptoms, then you will continue to solve symptoms. The core won't get solved, right? For example, we always do that. A laptop goes off, we'll typically restart. And thinking that, okay, this is going to get solved. But that's more like solving symptoms. Do you get to the root cause? So at GoQuick also, there's a culture of getting to the root cause, identifying why this happened, how it could have been prevented, even for, let's say, small bugs, errors. But going back, so that's how it started, wherein I had certain problem statements, validated with the market, went down, understood what is the consumer pain point, then prepared 7-8 solutions for it, went to the market, few merchants, tested with them, spoke with multiple VCs on how does this sound to you from a problem validation aspect. And then, you know, when there was a lot of resounding yes from a lot of people that, okay, this looks fascinating, it's going to work, looks like a great GTM, etc., etc. And, you know, that's how it started.
Right. Okay. So I think that's more than enough background for us to get into actually what GoQuick does. If I understand correctly, you solve problems across the funnel, you know, from conversion optimization to something like return to origin, right? Which is a key problem for e-commerce merchants as such. So could you describe GoQuick in your own words and also talk about a few popular use cases?
Yeah. So GoQuick, as I said, is a company which is trying to democratize shopping experience. In other words, we're saying, can we provide Amazon type experience to the non-Amazon world, right? That's our vision. And as I said, that there are four buckets. What we've done is we've started with conversion as the first bucket, wherein even if you start to break down conversion also, or we like to put it as that we're in the business of improving GMV by solving shopping experience. Now, if you start to break down GMV, it is transaction into AOV, and we further break down transaction, then it is conversion rate into number of visitors on the website. Right. Today, we solve everything from a conversion rate aspect, wherein if you have someone on the website, then can we help you convert better? And we look at return to origin as a conversion rate problem. Why? Because when we went deeper into the nature of the problem, we realized that this is a large consumer intent problem vis-a-vis to originally thought of as a supply chain problem. I like to give this example or analogy that in a credit risk space, right, once you have given a loan, then it becomes a collection problem. It's no more a credit risk problem. So in our business also, which order has to be given COD and which order doesn't need to be given COD is the decision to be taken. Once that is taken, then it becomes a delivery problem. And if you go deeper into it, you will realize that, you know, it's largely a consumer intent problem more than a logistic problem. It was originally thought to be largely a logistic problem, the KPI risk with the supply chain guy, etc., etc. I think the way to, I was giving you this analogy that the way to look at credit risk is that once you've given a loan, then after giving the loan, it becomes a collection problem. It's no more a credit risk problem. Same with our case, that you need to analyze whether we need to offer COD to this person or this transaction or not. Once it is given, then it becomes a logistic problem. Right. So hence, we are in the business of predicting consumer intent via a lot of data science heavy lifting. That's what we do. And we do a bunch of other products in form of checkout optimizations, which is taking over the transaction post add to cart till end of transaction, and help merchants realize higher GMV by way of higher prepaids, by way of higher conversions. We've seen up to 50% higher conversion rates, more than 20% increment in prepaids through our products. And similarly, on payment side, you know, we look at products from a very e-commerce lens. PGs look at from a payment gateway lens, we look at from an e-commerce lens. And I think that's what we get, that what should a merchant look at, what is a merchant supposed to look at, and can we solve their pain point? So we've been keeping a close ear to what merchant is saying, and just been building those products. And that's what has got us here.
Right. And if you talk to merchants often enough, you'll hear a plethora of problems, right? So I wonder, you know, how you prioritize some of this and how does it feed into your product roadmap and so on? I mean, you spoke about discovery, solutioning, and looking at it from the lens of conversion optimization. But how do you think of your product roadmap as such?
Well, that's a great question. I think any business, if you start speaking to customer, and if customer starts to believe that you can actually solve their problem, then they'll come to you with loads of requests, right, that this should be done, etc., etc. And I think we have some clear lens of what is our business. So we keep that at the center, and we always have a merchant backward approach. So we would definitely want to put customer anecdote over data and then start to look at things that, okay, is this feature which is requested, is it applicable to large majority of merchants, or is it a single large merchant request? And, you know, we have seen very, very different things. So, for example, a new feature request from a small merchant also most likely is a request which will be used by everyone. So it is believed otherwise that a large merchant request will be needed by everyone. But we have seen, at least our data indicates, that a small merchant request is typically would be used by everyone. So
it's interesting, right? Maybe a large merchant request, I mean, people are not mature enough to experience that pain, basically, right?
Yes. And, you know, what happens in SaaS companies is that you end up prioritizing for the large merchant. You know, so those requests are typically taken up and you tend to make them. There's nothing wrong in it. But I think we are in the business of democratizing shopping experience. We believe that we need to power everyone from small to large to extra large. So that's how we look at it. But you are so right that in terms of prioritization, it is always a challenge from a roadmap perspective. But I think what we do is we lay out what Amazon has taught us, that we lay out a 1.5 year PR article saying that this is what the news should be in December 2022. And then work backwards from there that, okay, this is the vision. Now, can we work backwards and say this is, you know, this is all what we will do in the product roadmap. And in this and in that one, first 3 months are very, very frozen in terms of what all is going to be there. And of course, we keep buffer in terms of, you know, till date, we keep a buffer of 40%, 45% of our bandwidth is ad hoc plus new feature request. So very cognizant of the fact that we will miss certain things which merchants will request and we'll end up making. And then, you know, we keep evolving. So it's a rolling 3 month plan, not a quarterly basis. It's a rolling 3 month plan, which will continue to evolve and keep tracking that whatever was our North Star number or vision, Was that right? Was that wrong? Can we modify? Were we audacious enough? So we keep questioning all of that to keep, stretching ourselves that are we really thinking big?
Right. And if you look at the distribution side of things, because as you mentioned, it's pretty important, very important, in fact, right? So how does customer acquisition work for you? You know, because as I said, e-commerce enablement itself is becoming a pretty big category, and there are literally hundreds or maybe thousands of plugins and so on that people can use. But at the same time, merchants may not be savvy enough to discover some of these tools or solutions for themselves, and they may need some help and guidance and whatnot, right? So are you looking at it a little more consultatively? Because when I look at the GoQuick website, I mean, it seems like a one-stop shop for all merchant problems on conversion, right? So how does acquisition work for you?
We have been, I would say, there is a good product market fit for our kind of product. Ours is kind of a performance product. It works. And there is an inbuilt product-led growth, wherein it's a network business. Now we have close to 80 million users, so who are powered on the network in different ways. Hence, it becomes no-brainer for a lot of e-commerce players to look at our business, look at joining us. And with that lens, I think we do see a lot of inbound requests coming our way. Our business is mostly inbound in nature. We do have a smallish 4-5 people sales team, which is mostly dealing with some amount of strategic clients, some clients which you want to reach out to. Enterprise won't do a lot of, or at least large Excel and enterprise won't do a lot of inbound stuff. Those are the merchants which they go after. But I think in our business, CAC has never been a concern. You know, there is practically, if your product works, then people are happy to put it on. If it doesn't work, then, you know, it's a difficult sell. So that's the way to look at it. And I think it's been true for a lot of product-led SaaS companies, that if you believe in PLG, then you tend to power it that way. And in India, at least I would say the ecosystem is not very, very large, that the word spreads quickly. There are WhatsApp groups everywhere around which are there of founders, or of digital growth marketers, etc. And the word gets out very quickly, which works both ways, right? Positive as well as negative. And so that's how at least it's been working for us. But it was initial first 10, 12, 15 months. Now we'll ramp up on our marketing efforts, sales efforts.
Right. And what are some high-level challenges that you're solving right now as a founder, you know, to power the next level of growth for GoQuick?
So, you know, it's a little tricky that when you start a business, the first challenge is that you need to find out some early sense of some product market fit, that is there a early PMF which is visible? That's what you are searching for. The next one is there a scalable product market fit? And then, of course, there is profitable product market fit. I think we are in the phase where it is about scalable product market fit. And once you start to get into product market fit zone, typically what happens is that your team sizes expand, whatever was okay to ignore in the early stage now suddenly starts to become starts to be visible as a crack. So you need people to fill those gaps. What it means is that as a company, from a headcount perspective, you start to grow. That becomes a challenge, that how do you now build out the org design? How do you ensure that there is culture? How do you ensure that alignment of purpose of what we're trying to achieve? And, you know, there is a deeper nuance there, that interpretation of a sentence in remote world can be very, very different for 10 different people. And you will realize this when there is an end of sprint, end of month, that they were busy in doing something, but it wasn't leading to the objective. So my job has become, in addition to the new product discoveries, is one, getting the right team in place. So getting right product folks, right senior people in the team. I think I would say touchwood, we've done well there, wherein we have some senior folks from product industry who've joined us from Amazon, Swiggy, Flipkart, Razorpay, PayU. So they've joined us. Similar in customer success, we have folks from MoEngage, some of these large global Sprinklr, some of these large global CS companies. And similar in technology, we have folks from Amazon, Flipkart, who have started to join us. So that way, I think we've done well. I think now it's about how do we keep them aligned to single objectives, what the company is trying to chase, keep repeating them, you know, reinforcing them and making way for also them, right? You, when you hire senior people, you need to make way also for them that how do they become successful, right? They don't need to, they know their job, right? They don't need to be coached on the skill. I think just that the environment is, context is new for them. So how do you give them the right context? How do you ensure that there are small wins, early wins available for them before they start to, you know, roll on their own? So that's become some part of our job in addition to what we've been doing, right? From managing investors to managing clients to ensuring that our products are performing.
At some level, the founder's job is very simple in the sense that you hire the best people and then you enable them, right? If only it was that simple. So
it's easier said than done. But you're right that at every stage, I would say a different skill set is required. At least I have a view on this, that if we would have got some great 1 to 10 folks in 0 to 1 phase, we would have probably boxed ourselves in a very, very different way. But what it meant was that we had certain kind of people in 0 to 1. Now they need to be transitioned to the 1 to 10 phase. So they need to be coached, mentored, trained on what is the new expectation, help them develop the skill, be patient there. So those are some of the things which we are doing, investing in their success as a company. You're right that hiring is an important task, and that's probably what I do. I end up spending 60% of my time on hiring and managing some of those people. Yeah, I think you bang on there.
So just a follow-up on that note, right? I mean, you mentioned 0 to 1 and 1 to 10. I think you need very different mindsets operationally to function in both these phases. What are some of those characteristics that you see of people, you know, who can function in both, right? I mean, who have done the 0 to 1 and are now like, you know, really kicking ass in the 1 to 10 journey?
It's a tough one. Mentally, first you have to accept that this is a change of arena, right? It's a tough one because you're working with the same set of people. And now, you know, we used to celebrate a lot of firefighting when we started out the business. That's how it works. And now we changed gears to saying that now no more celebration of firefighting. We started with safe to fail to now a scaled up product can't be, you know, you can't push out something which suddenly stops to work. So it forces you to reflect a lot of on your initial values to now a scaled up company has different values. Right. Or those interpretations become a little difficult that you can fail, but you can't fail on prod. You can fail on dev modes. You can fail on documents, but you have to got it right on production. Right. So I think, and in 0 to 1 phase, I would say there is a lot of data. In absence of data, there is a lot of gut which a founder has that, okay, this is what I believe is going to work. And you have a very smallish team. So good part is that you have a smallish team who can rally around you and you get momentum because it's a lean team. One single thing you hit and you are on. Now in this phase, the moment at least mass expands because the number of people expand. And now it's about that, okay, can you get into that rhythm of managing people? People are your leverage. Good part is that you get a lot of data now. So now it's no more about that gut. It has to be data-driven decision-making. If you start to make gut calls now, then I think you're doing disservice because now there is so much data which is coming your way and you need to take informed decisions basis those data, right? So that's how it starts to change. You know, from a founder perspective, you were used to taking some gut calls. Now you have to change gears and you have to take data-driven calls. You were used to throwing people at the problem. Now you're saying, let me get some specialists and ask them to do their jobs. You were used to living in a very, very ambiguous world wherein, you know, I having very, very high self-belief that, okay, we're going to win from here, to now having a very different set of people who know that, okay, this is my domain. We're going to clearly draw our swim lanes and this is where we will run. So that's how it changes.
Right. It's a great summary. You know, one thing that we ask entrepreneurs on the podcast is, what are those unique insights from operating in the space that you operate that could be useful to someone who is not used to this, right? I mean, someone who's looking on from the outside on e-commerce enablement and saying that, hey, I should probably, you know, build a business in this. It seems like, you know, building shovels in a gold rush, right? I mean, so let me think of some technology solution for all of these growing e-commerce merchants or whatever. What are some two or three things they should keep in mind? What are those things they may not know just from looking at it from the outside?
I would say, I think we have been lucky that, you know, e-commerce has really grown very, very fast in the last 1.5-2 years. But that we wouldn't have predicted, you know, that this is going to happen this way. So I would say, let's continue to be long-term bullish on the trend, right? That's number one for me, that you are in a space which is going to grow. And then you start to look at, you know, which is very, very positive for me. For example, the market this year might not be as bullish as what it was last year. But that doesn't mean that e-commerce is not growing. We are still less than 10% of retail is e-commerce, right? So you have to look at it from a macro perspective, that where is this headed, right? As the younger generation catches on, they become mainstream, where is this headed? So if you're bullish on that, then there is meaning to going deeper in terms of what are the different problem statements. And you can look at it from different perspectives. What are the new emerging trends in e-commerce, right? Where is e-commerce going to happen in our country? Is it going to be NFT, Web3, metaverses of the world? Or is it going to happen on WhatsApp? Is it going to happen on social? Is it going to happen on Insta? And that's where you will realize that a lot of opportunities, while the retail, I like to put it this way, that history repeats itself, but in a new avatar. So you will see retail will continue to happen, but the format will change, something will change. Hence, it will give everyone a new opportunity. So and shopping experience, you know, which takes me back to a very interesting one, that when we started the company, we had two names. One was GoQuick, second was Safecart, wherein we thought that, okay, shopping experience will be about safety. Is my shopping experience safe, etc.? And the other one is that shopping experience will always be about smoothness, convenience. And when we went deeper into it, we realized that this is going to always be about convenience, while safety will become hygiene. So you will continue to see more convenience problems being there. And similarly, as I was saying, where is consumer moving? Consumer is, let's say, moving to WhatsApp, Instagram, social of the world. So that's where opportunity is. You look at it from a technology point of view. Where is technology moving? So is technology giving you more opportunities? Will there be a face ID which will detect you and say, okay, I smile and the shopping is done? So that's where the world is headed. And then you, as an entrepreneur, you take a call that, okay, if this is a 2-year thing which is going to happen, can I grab this as a starting point and build out a e-commerce enablement business or any kind of business, right? And I think one thing which is very, very clear to me is that it's a long-term play. It's not, any business is not going to work out in a couple of years. It's going to take 7-10 years. So we better commit to it long term. This is a, you know, even it's a VC backed business, traditional business, bootstrap business. Everything works on compounding. So that's the holy grail, which by nature, by design, it is supposed to happen in long term.
Fantastic. So Chirag, before you leave, any books or podcasts that you would recommend to our listeners?
I can recommend a lot of books depending on topics, but some of the good ones, at least, which I reread every quarter, is the first one is High Output Management by Andy Grove. So that's at least on top of my list. Then for SaaS businesses, I think there is a good one called From Impossible to Inevitable. Very, very good. Yeah, so good one. Then I think generally, if anyone is a fan of probabilistic thinking, then Thinking in Bets is a great one. That how do you think, it doesn't come naturally to us. Then I think Factfulness is another one which I like. But I'm a Nassim Taleb fan, so Black Swan, I can go on. From a podcast perspective, I used to like Tim Ferriss' show, but I'm a regular listener of Knowledge Project, Farnham Street. So that one I definitely listen to. And then there's another one called Masters of Scale by Reid Hoffman. These are at least which are coming to my mind at the moment. Yeah.
Right. Great recommendations. Again, thank you so much for being on the podcast, Chirag. This was super insightful and I'm sure that it will be very valuable to our listeners. Thank you.
Thanks, Roshan. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Startup Operator Podcast. We put out a couple of episodes every week and a roundup where we talk about the news and events from the Indian startup ecosystem. Do share all of this content with your fellow startup operators. It could be valuable and insightful for them. Also, before you leave, follow us on social media. We're on LinkedIn and Twitter, and subscribe to our WhatsApp newsletter if you want all of this content delivered to your inbox. Thank you and have a great day.